So we are now recording the audio to the cloud, and I will turn it over to Alan, and Alan is going to lead us through tonight's deck, and we hope that Alan's internet connection is more stable than it has been in the past. If not, I have the deck, and I will jump in if he disappears.
Perfect. Okay, thanks, Chris, and good evening, everyone.
Wait, Chris, are you going to mute all?
Oh, yeah. Of course I'm going to forget something, right? So, mute all, and yes, and everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves, but please don't unless you're intending to actually converse with the group. Alan, back to you. Unmute yourself.
Yes, I'm trying to find a command to do that. Yeah, so I guess I need to put another bullet on the slide, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right, we have a few things in the pipe already, but I don't think we're going to have enough for the full hour, so if anybody has any questions, put them in the chat window or ask them later on. I think we'll have lots of time. First thing I've got is a share. I booted up Windows the other day and found I had a new friend on the taskbar. It was 21 degrees Celsius and mostly cloudy. And if I clicked on that icon, I got a whole bunch of news stories about people being dead and Justin being in Brussels and so on and so forth. I didn't actually ask for that, so I wondered where it came from. And it turns out that this month, in fact, Microsoft has enabled this news and weather widget, which they call News and Interests. And it will show you weather and sports scores and all kinds of things that you don't actually need or want. At least I don't need or want them. So my guess was, how do I turn it off? Well, it turns out it's actually pretty easy. You just right-click on the taskbar on the widget, and it will pop up this sidebar menu right here, pick up News and Interests, and then simply click on Turn Off, and that disables the widget. And that's all she wrote. Okay, moving along. We have a share from Linda.
Okay, thanks, Alan. This was actually something that Lawrence discovered and thought it might make a good share, so I said I'd be willing to put a couple of slides together. So it's the ability to reduce documents that you've made in Windows. So it could be a Word document, PowerPoint, Excel, doesn't matter. But if you've got images or graphs or photos in it, then they can get quite large, and you may not need to have it that the image is that great a quality, but it's a pain in the neck sometimes to resize them all before you put them in or whatever. So this allows you to reduce the size. And I think it'd be great for sharing, like if you have to email something to someone, or if somebody's downloading a document from a Dropbox area, like I post my PowerPoint presentations from my various photo lectures. And the smaller it is, the better if people want to download them. And then for my sake, it's better if my cloud storage isn't crowded, so it will take less space on the cloud, and so I can post more things, and it'll take less space on my computer. But just make sure that the resolution that you're resizing it to is adequate for your purposes, and if you're not sure, just make a copy under another name, and so have a small copy if you want to put that one up on the cloud, but keep a full resolution one behind just in case. Okay, next slide, please. So it's not difficult. You just go through the file save as process, and here's, you know, where you could rename it if you wished. But if you don't, otherwise you could leave it, and just click on Tools and then Compress Pictures. Next slide. And when you're doing an entire document like this, it's kind of an all or nothing tool. So the apply only to this picture is going to be grayed out. But do make sure that the delete cropped areas of your pictures is checked off. It seems to be a default, but just make sure that that's ticked off, because if you have cropped within a document, photos or whatever, that area you crop still stays there. You don't see it, but it's there. And if you compress the picture, it's going to include that unless you let the program delete that. So that makes a nice, even smaller file. And then you choose your resolution. Oops, you choose your resolution. And so I've got ticked off there the web one, but you can go even smaller for email or print. It gives you lots of good options for resolution. Okay, next. So if you do want to just change the size or compress just one picture in a document, say there's just one particular picture, then you can do it under the Format tab in Word or Excel or PowerPoint, but click on the picture first, then I'd probably picture first, then Format tab, and then compress picture, and then you will get the apply only to this picture, and then that should be ticked off at that point. Next. So here's just an example of one of the PowerPoint presentations I made on basic photo editing. It started at 40 megabytes, and I didn't choose the smallest. I chose that web-based one, and I got it reduced down to 18 megabytes. So I'm very happy that Lawrence stumbled upon this, because I will definitely use it. That's it.
Okay, thanks very much, Linda. I'm sure that will be a handy tip for a bunch of people, since it applies to all of those packages.
Yeah.
But useful. Okay, moving along, our next share is from Tom. He has a program he's going to demo to us called Popfile, which is a Bayesian classifier for email. And Tom is going to share his screen, Chris.
Yeah, he's co-host, so Tom, you can go ahead and share your screen. I don't see Tom in the list anymore. I think we've lost Tom.
He was there.
Sorry. Yeah, he is there. Yep. Okay.
But I have to unmute myself.
Okay,
it works
good.
A lot better that way.
Yes.
So Popfile is a way of classifying your emails automatically. It
did
does
you
them.
Share your screen yet, Tom?
Oh, didn't I share the screen? Sorry. Okay. I have to choose the screen. I got to vote. Okay, that, and share. That should be usable. So it's a way of classifying your emails automatically, and it does this on when you download them. It does this by way of Bayesian classification, which associates different words with your categories with various probabilities. And it does this by you educating it. And it then adds the category in a subject, a line, or a heading. So, for example, here, it's looked at this part of this. This is a part of a message from Micheline lately. And you can see the colors of the different words. And these correspond to the colors of the buckets or categories. And it's... Popfile has made the estimation now that this particular email is actually belonged in 5-dash computing bucket with a probability that's fairly high. And the way you show your category of the email or the way you use it in a filter is either to put it in an extra header in the email as you download it, which is this one, PF class or Popfile class. And the way you would correct it if it's wrong would be to use this link here, which is 127.0.0.1 is your own computer. And I'm using port 9090 for Popfile. And then it goes to jump to message and the particular message. And messages, I've set it up. You can keep messages in its database for quite a long while. I've set it up to keep it for 8 days, and after that, it automatically gets deleted from the database of Popfile. So you would use these particular headers if your email program can filter on the basis of what's in a particular header. You can also add the category to the subject line, subject header modification. These are all my buckets or categories. And I have actually, you can do this simply and just have good stuff and or work and personal and spam, but I've actually divided things up. I have fraud and I have virus as well as, where's spam? Spam is there. So you can classify them. It does an automatic job of classifying them. The colors only matter when you actually want to look inside the messages. It doesn't have any other use. But you can put it in the subject line. You can do that PF class header and the link for correcting the correct category for the particular email that you're looking at. And when you put it in the subject line, it looks like this. The requirements are that you actually have a POP3 mail client on your computer. It only operates with POP3. It doesn't operate with SMTP. It's only on incoming mail. And you set up POPFile as a proxy email server. And it does support secure transport with your email server. In other words, you would set up POPFile as the secure connector to your mail server. And then on your own computer, you actually use 110, use an unsecured connection to POPFile from your mail program. And you use the web browser to control or update. As for learning, this is the link that you would use to actually correct the email. And what you get is a thing, something like this, where you have the from to blah, blah. And this is one of the message numbers. And you would actually choose from this list. You may notice that I've used 0 to Z to lead each kind of classification because it makes it simpler. You just put in, type the letter and then reclassify. And POPFile says, oh, all these words are more for N/BBO category than any other. So how many buckets? There's no limit. I limit to 36, but if you have 1,000, I think it would probably take 1,000. And it would probably do certainly a faster and perhaps even a better job than you in classifying your emails. Once you classify them, and so you have the header and so on, then your email program would have to have a filter to actually put it in the folder that you wanted. And here's the sort of accuracy I get. The accuracy is based on how many messages I've received, and this may be a little misleading. I get a lot of messages from lists, and so they're usually classified correctly. And so I've had 2,000 classification errors, in other words, corrections that I've made since 2013. And here are all the messages. And you can see these colors are the correspond to these things. And, for example, I've only had 218 viruses since 2013. As for spam, I've had 80,000. It also has a count of the words that it's stored for each of your categories if you're interested in that. And those are the links. To get it, you would get it, you would install it, and then it will lead you through. And it's fairly easy to install. If you've installed your own email program, then that should be fine. Are there any questions?
There was nothing in the queue, I don't think. If anybody has any questions, you want to unmute yourself and ask it or put something in the chat for us.
I don't have a question, but I do have a comment. My first exposure to Bayesian filtering for spam was from an article, A Plan for Spam, from back in 2002. And I posted the link into the chat for anybody who's interested in reading it. It is kind of an interesting thing to go through. And this gentleman, Paul Graham, who came up with this idea, he goes into some detail. One of the things I find that is really neat about Bayesian filtering is that it really is customized to your definition of what spam is and the types of email that you get. It's statistical on what you receive. So if you were a doctor, you know, you might have a lot of things that other people would consider spam that are not spam for you. You know, it's part of your job. And so by using a Bayesian filter, you don't end up filtering out things that perhaps are not spam for you, but are for the majority of the people in the world. So Bayesian is kind of neat.
Or you could have, as a doctor, you could have stuff regarding to legs set into one folder, stuff regarding to prostates in another, and so on. So it's you set up the categories you want. And the categories that I've set up here, as you can see, I have a bunch. They're the things that I'm interested in. Canoe camping, I want to bring out subs. This is politics, that's computing, so on, bike touring. Personal, kind of unclassified, Toastmasters, and so on. So there's a and I have another fourth category, stock fraud. I haven't had any stock frauds in the last 10 years or so.
Lucky you.
Mike's asking, is this the POP program freeware?
Is there a what program?
Is POP file freeware?
Yes, it is freeware, and it's quite old. It hasn't been changed in 5 or 6 years, but it works fine. You do install it. It looks, let's try get out of there. When it's in your taskbar, it looks like this. And I have it set up to actually run as soon as, shortly after I log in. And this is my mail program.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom. This is very interesting. Let me switch screens again here. Okay, our next share is from yours truly. I had a question from somebody about this space on the Android phone, and I just thought I'd throw a few things together because it's a neat app that you can use to try and figure some things out. But just in general, if I've been looking at Android's file system recently, trying to understand it, and it's basically really complex. It's a very strange system. It's based on Linux, but it's a different animal in quite a few different ways. One of the things that people complain about on the web a lot is that the available disk space never adds up to the amount of storage that they have on their device. And that's basically, of course, because the system files are taking some of the space, and Android doesn't let you see the system files. So you can't actually account for all the storage space very easily. And as a regular user, you'll only see very few of the folders that Android actually uses. You see the user space, but you don't see anything else, essentially. And because of that, because they hide the OEM apps, the pre-installed apps, in the system folders, it means that you can't delete pre-installed apps, which is a huge problem if you have a lot of bloatware on the system and yet you have an old phone that doesn't have all that much memory, and the system's grabbing more memory than user space, essentially. And then the next big thing is that it's terribly confusing in terms of internal storage, external storage, and they both pretend that they're SD cards, and there are different disks, there are different folders, and there are lots of files, and some of them seem to be the same, and there's no rhyme or reason to a lot of it. And I found this wonderful quote from a few years ago from a Reddit user. He says he wants to say that the Android storage system is a tragedy. There are too many partitions, too many folders, and too many locations to store files. And I would certainly agree with that wholeheartedly. However, if you want to take a look at your device and try and figure out what's going on and maybe where the big space hogs are, what you need is an app. And what I've been using recently is called Explore File Manager. And it's a bit like Chris's favorite, was it File Commander or something like that?
Total Commander.
It uses a two-pane view of the system. So you can see kind of two folders, two disks at once, whatever. It will actually give you root access if your phone is rooted, which is really useful. But your phone has to be rooted to do that. And then it has all kinds of options for zip files and FTP and that kind of thing. The really neat utility is this thing called Disk Map. So basically, you point at a drive, hit the Disk Map icon, and it displays, gives you a graphical representation of the folders that are in use, and it organizes them by size. So clearly, the biggest folder taking the most disk space comes up first. So it's pretty easy to track down what's actually taking up the space. Whether you can do anything about it or not is another matter, but at least you can identify things. And if you use a cloud storage, then it also gives you direct access to things like Google Drive and Dropbox and that kind of thing. So when you run the app, you basically see a screen like this, you're looking at my smartphone here. So the internal storage is shown here, and I've got about just under a gigabyte of free space out of nominally 4.5 gig. I have a micro SD card installed, which is essentially a 32 gig card, and I've got about 9 gigabytes free. And my phone is actually rooted, so I'm seeing different things than other people would. If you don't have root access, you won't see some of these things. However, I highlighted the SD card here, and then I scrolled down on the right-hand side through these icons and found Disk Map. So now I want to hit Disk Map because, as I said, it will give me this graphical representation of the folders. And the problem really is that you've got such a tiny little screen, and this isn't the most user-friendly representation of the different folder areas. But you can see some things immediately that I'm using 20 plus gigabytes on the SD card. Almost 18 plus gigabytes to that are a backup system called TWRP, the Team Win Recovery Project. So these are backups of my entire phone and multiple backups. So that's why they're taking so much space. And so I can save some space by just deleting some of those backups. But then down the bottom here, you'll also see I've got this folder called Received Files, and it's using almost a gigabyte. And that is a folder which I have created in order to be able to easily transfer files to and from my phone and the personal computer. So those are all my files. I can do anything I want with those too. So the way to do this is to use the two fingers and zoom the screen so you can get a better idea of what's going on. And you can see that the Android folder, the data folder, is taking about 1.3 gigabytes and change. And these are basically user-installed programs. So you can see here I've got one called Merlin Bird, which is a birding field guide. So it's got pictures of birds and songs of birds and maps of birds. And it's a real, and there's, it's really big. It's the whole of North America. So 900 megabytes of stuff there. And then this one is MapFactor Navigator, which is my GPS mapping app, which again is almost half a gig. And clearly I don't want to lose any of those. So let's have a look down in receive files here. And one of the things I see immediately is I've got half a gig there, a couple of half a gigs, which are actually updates to my custom ROM, my Android custom ROM. So this is Lineage OS. So I've got almost a, 900 megabytes of stuff there, which are waiting to be transferred to my PC if I so desire. And then if I go down a bit further, you can see I've got this folder called DCIM. I forget what that, digital something image manager. No, digital camera images. That's what it's supposed to stand for. So this folder DCIM camera has about 84 megabytes of photographs. So one of the things I do is I take pictures on my phone, but then to free up space, I will transfer these files to my PC and to offline storage. And then once I've done that, I can delete them from my phone. So I can actually use this Explorer file manager to do that. I've moved the photos onto my PC. So now I look at the folder, I can see I've got all these pictures of the garden or something. And right here is a grayed out check mark. And if I click on that, then I can select all of the images. And then again, if I scroll down these various icons, I can find the delete icon. And if I click on that delete icon, then all those icons will disappear. Explorer has another little neat trick. If you want to check how big a particular folder is, so let's go back to this camera folder. If I long press, so I just click on the camera icon and hold it down, then it pops up a context menu. And that context menu has one of the options is show details. So if I show details, then it tells me that it tells me where this camera folder is actually located. And in particular, it tells me that I've got one image in there right now, and it's using 1.68 megabytes. So you can easily identify how many files and how big, how much disk space those files are taking in any given folder. Another quite useful option is in this menu is copy. So what you can do here is using that two-pane system, you can identify the target directory where you want to copy the files to. You can navigate to the source directory and say the pictures, and you can toggle between them using this two-pane icon, and if that's what you want to do. You can use that tagging system to select one or more or all of the files in the folder, and then you can use this context menu to copy them to the target. And once you hit the copy menu, you have a checkbox you can select to move them instead of copying them. So that if you're moving them onto, so let's say you're moving them from internal storage to the external storage, by moving them, you're freeing up space on the internal storage, which again can be quite useful. So if you have problems with your phone, I will put together some different ways to free up more space on your Android phone. And the other way to do it is just buy a new phone, because they all come with like 32 or 64 gigabytes of storage these days, and space doesn't seem to be a problem anymore. Anyway, that's all I have. I, Somebody's telling me I could buy a 400 gig micro SD card. That's true.
Your phone might not be able to read it, though.
That's also true.
Well, even 64 gigabyte cards these days are like $20. So.
Oh, yeah.
Well, by the way, this makes me think of dash cams. Apparently, well, dash cams, they record continuously, at least while you're driving and sometimes while you're parked. And apparently there are some endurance SDs that will live a lot longer than regular SDs than a dash cam. If you look for them, there's some reviews on YouTube.
Okay, there were, I see some questions in the thing here. Tom is pointing out that POP file doesn't work with IMAP, so you have to use a POP account. Micheline wants to know if I'm talking about Android phones or Android computers, because she doesn't think that phones have disks. Well, it turns out phones have solid-state drives, essentially, chips built in them, which look like disks and act like disks, and they're really solid-state disks, I guess. But they also have micro SD cards, which kind of a disk, but it's really a external device. Alan's getting, Lawrence says, I'm getting a secret commission to buy a new phone. There you go. I have to buy myself a new phone first, though, Lawrence. Mine is a 2015 vintage.
Talking about buying a new phone, I got rid of my Samsung, which came with bloatware and lots of programs that I never used. And I got myself a couple of years back an LG One, which allows me to delete programs I don't need that come when you purchase the phone. So that's another way to save space.
The other thing would be to go with, any pure Android phone, like a Google Pixel or something like that, it has a lot less crap installed on it, and apparently you can remove just about everything on it app-wise if you really want to, if you go pure Android. I think the OnePlus phone is also that way, that it doesn't come with all kinds of crap added onto it.
Elvin wants to know if anybody's ever bought a Blackview phone. Anybody know what a Blackview phone is?
I assume Eldon knows what it is. Eldon, you could unmute yourself and say what it is that you're interested in about it.
I see them advertised quite a bit, and they're known for their ruggedness. My son has one, and he loves it. He's had it for a long time. His came with a thimble imager on it, too. And you can take a picture of, a wire and see if it's hot or anything. They're very popular. Well, they seem to be very popular, and I think I would consider one next time I'm ready to trade up.
Oh, just recently, you may have heard of it. There are 700 or 800 arrests of criminals using an Anom phone, or at least an Android phone with the Anom software on it. But the FBI was listening into all of these, and they ran it for a few years, and then they realized that some people were actually becoming more suspicious of it. So then they swept in on 700 or 800 criminals around the world with cooperation of other police forces. So it's hard to trust everything.
I'm just looking at store.blackview.hk, and actually they're pretty inexpensive phones. So they have about $400 for 8 gig of RAM and 128 gig storage. And it's running a Helio P90 octa-core processor. It's got a Sony 48 megapixel triple rear camera and thermal imaging camera, dual SIM, 4G global network.
The specs on them are pretty impressive, actually.
Yeah. Anybody know what the country code is for HK?
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong, I guess, yeah.
And they actually are always running sales on the versions that they might be discontinuing, and you can get them for like 50% off, and they're still good phones.
Yeah, looks very interesting. I presume it's Android.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Wendy says, can you share the link to that phone, Chris?
Sure. I will paste it in right now.
Google black for your phones and it'll come up, no problem.
Yeah.
And if you're ever on, I mean, if you're ever just on the internet, you know, the ads come up quite frequently.
I guess I'll probably get them all the time now that I visited their website.
Sucker!
I should always remember before starting Q&A that I should start an anonymous session or something.
You see ads? Shame on you.
Sign in as Alan Germain, Chris.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, everyone. All right, we have a special share from Justin Dwyer. So, Josh, you want to share your screen?
And unmute yourself.
All right. I need the permission to share.
You have permission.
Oh, there it is. Okay. Jeez, where did it go? Just 1 second. Sorry.
Yeah, you're co-host, so you should have no problem sharing.
Yes. Okay. I got it. Sorry. I was looking at that Blackview thing. where did it go? There. Okay. Share and this will stop other. Yeah. Oh, somebody asked. Okay. That will stop other screen to share. All right.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Basically, I have an old test equipment that works fine under Windows 10. And the problem I had is that in order to use the ELP, I had to download a pretty big file. And when I tried to open the ELP file, it didn't work. And I did some research, and somebody did posted a similar question also on the Google emails. And so I did share that what I found. So basically, it's a way to tell Windows 10 that the ELP is Windows 7, and then it works fine. So I'm going to share copy the link on the chat. And so for people that are using old program and need to use the ELP that doesn't work, that might be a solution to their problem. Because it works fine. It's just a matter to convince Windows 10 that yes, you can use it. So that's it for me.
Just a comment on that. I seem to recall that the reason why WinHelp 32 was dropped was due to some security problem that Microsoft didn't want to deal with or something like that, but I'm not 100% sure. So let me just Google a little bit for it and see.
In my case, it's an old test program, so I'm quite convinced that there is no problem with it. But you may want.
Well, it could be, you know, it could be another piece of malware that would take advantage of it. Like, you know, somebody would send you a crafted help file that you double click on it, and because of the vulnerability that is in WinHelp 32, it could compromise your computer. I do see something going back to 2004, a heap-based buffer overflow in WinHelp 32. I'm not sure. I might read up a little bit more on that, but just a little bit of a caution that I don't think Microsoft would have dropped WinHelp32.exe unless they had a reason for it. So actually there's an exploit DBA from 2010. There is some information around on the fact that it has had vulnerabilities, and I just don't know if the last version still had those. I have stuff going to 2011 that talks about code execution vulnerabilities in WinAlp 32. So just a slight caution on it. I guess if people wanted to be really safe, you know, use the program for the help files that you need to use it for, and then maybe rename winhelp32.exe to something else when you're not using it. And that way, you're not going to get, you know, an exploit happening on your computer unexpectedly. So just a little bit of caution.
There may be a sneaky way to avoid this, and that's that you set your WinHelp file up to open things like XXX files or something like that. And then when you have a help file that you need to open, you just change the file type to be XXX. And then that might help avoid kind of files automatically being opened by WinHelp.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah. You'd still have to go through the steps that Jocelyn detailed on how to get WinHelp, because it doesn't come with Windows 10. So you'd still have to get the winhelp32.exe file. But, yeah, in terms of having it not execute automatically, if you get a malicious help file, that's a good point. Although I suspect, too, that hackers are probably looking at it as a really diminishing target out there that would be vulnerable to it. So you're probably not going to see an awful lot of exploits using winhelp32.exe.
Yeah, that WinHelp is no longer included in Windows 10 now active lockets. Yeah. So there's definitely something going on there.
Yeah. But as you say, if you've got some program and the only help you can get is in the help file that's available on it, it's a shame not to be able to access that help file.
Yeah, and those help files, some of those programs can be quite extensive. So I don't know if those help files will be ever converted to a newer version. But anyway,
yeah,
if someone is stuck with that, that might be a useful tip to have.
But yeah, for sure.
But as they say in the text, in the link I sent, is that when you install a new version of Windows or an update, you may have to rerun the program again. So.
I just put a link in the chat. Apparently there are ways to convert an HLP file to a CHM. So, but then it still won't be automatically accessible from the program, but at least you can open it up outside of the program.
Oh, that's a good idea, too. Yeah, that's a really good idea to convert it to CHM.
Have you ever tried that program? Or does it work?
I may have years ago. I haven't played with it in the last 6 or 7 years.
Okay. Well,
there you go,
Josh.
Yeah, you can report and do a share on it next week. Good deed never goes unpunished.
No guarantee, but if I get a chance, I will. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh. That was really good.
Yeah.
Okay, we're at that time of the night where the prepared deck is done, so if anybody has any questions, now is the time. Questions or comments? Or more shares?
I see Natalie has unmuted herself.
Yeah, I was just wondering, my keyboard, which is plugged in and working fine, every once in a while, it's been stopping to type. So then I noticed I had a little icon for a keyboard. It seems to be the Windows on-screen virtual keyboard. I disabled it, and it keeps interfering with my keyboard. And so I have to literally restart my computer for it to stop taking over. Is there something that I'm missing?
Wow, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's the last week. It's driving me crazy. I start typing and there's nothing.
Excuse me, Natalie?
Yeah.
Is your laptop, I'm assuming?
No, it's a tower.
Okay, so it's not a touchscreen then.
No, and it's plugged in, and yeah, it's just really weird.
Wireless keyboard?
Nope. USB connection.
Wow.
So yeah, I don't get it.
it started last week. Would that be right after the Windows update?
Oh, I don't know, but it's, oh no, not another thing.
You know what? It sounds, Natalie, that it could possibly be with that Windows update that something happened with the actual USB. There's like a power thing. You and I will have to get together offline, and I can walk you through the manager.
Okay.
In the device manager, I found that often sometimes you need to turn. It'll keep things under power while it's in sleeping mode, and you have to sort of turn things on or off to actually get them to work right in the device manager.
Okay, one other thing. Can you press Windows I right now to open up settings?
The original suggestion was ease of access.
And then keyboard, and they have a use the on-screen keyboard. Is that turned off?
Yeah.
Okay, there is a hotkey for Windows Control O. I don't imagine you accidentally are hitting that.
Nope.
But so the use on-screen keyboard is turned off, eh? Weird.
It's just weird.
Yeah.
It's Windows.
Try Alt-Shift for switching keyboard configurations. Maybe this will do something. You never know.
Okay. When that happens again, I'll...
Because that's how I switch keyboards configurations from French to English to, But I'm not sure if it will do something with the virtual keyboard.
Well, actually, I tried switching because I have several languages, and it didn't matter. It wouldn't type anything. It was disabled. Sorry? Mm-hmm.
In the keyboard setting, it says that the Win Control O is the toggle. So you might try toggling it to back to your physical keyboard.
But if she doesn't have a keyboard to type on.
Maybe a problem.
Yeah, I can't do anything with it. I literally had to bring up the on-screen and then use it to do anything. It was crazy.
So you could use it with your mouse.
Yeah.
Is it possible that the battery for the keyboard is low? Is there a battery in the keyboard?
It's wired.
Okay.
When it happens, so does the on-screen keyboard actually show up at that point?
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I thought, well, okay, I need to disable this thing, but it
won't. I don't know what's enabling it. So I think the next time it happens, what I would try is just, if you can, go to settings and see if it's turned itself on somehow. So okay. Through you should be able to mouse it to get to settings, ease of access keyboard, and then see if it somehow has turned itself back on there. I'm not sure what that's going to buy you, but it would be interesting if that still says it's turned off, yet the on-screen keyboard is actually popping up. That's really bizarre.
Mm-hmm. There's one other thing you can try, and that's check to see that tablet mode is not turned on. I think that's in the settings.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Tablet settings. If you look in the tablet settings, it says use the appropriate mode for my hardware, but you can say always use tablet mode and never use tablet mode. And if you never use tablet mode, then that should maybe help you.
Yeah, that might be. That's a good idea.
Thanks, I'll try.
One last suggestion. Did you try a different USB port?
I did.
Okay.
Thanks.
Did you try a different on-screen keyboard?
Yeah, change languages. That should work.
We're laughing with you, not at you.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm laughing at, I don't know, Windows? I don't know. Thank you.
Yeah, wait for the next monthly update. It'll mysteriously fix itself, maybe.
Yeah, I've noticed something. I've noticed other mysterious things happening since the last update. I'm getting there's a closed captioning thing in Windows from about 3 years ago that apparently has turned itself on a few times while I was playing a radio station. So Windows updates do strange things.
Yeah.
Now it got me thinking, too, there are often optional driver updates that you can install that may fix bizarre problems that you may have.
Yeah, that's true, but I tend to stay away from driver updates unless I know that there's an issue. But this could be one of those cases in point where, yeah, an optional driver update, who knows?
It might could at least something. Look and see what updates are available.
Yeah, yeah.
A BIOS update, too? Or just a firmware update?
Yeah, possibly.
The
manufacturer
is the desktop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Natalie?
Yep, thanks.
No, what manufacturer?
Oh, sorry. My computer?
Yes.
Acer.
Yeah, they definitely do have BIOS updates periodically. So going to their website and going to, you know, driver updates or something like that section or support section and looking up your model, it should come up with a list of all of the various updates that are available. And who knows, maybe one of those will fix it.
And actually, I think with the Acer, too, it comes with a whole set of allowing you to check your drivers automatically and then, you know, uploading the appropriate drivers.
Yeah. But that's an odd one.
Yeah, thanks.
I think we beat that to death.
Okay, well, now there's a question in the chat from Eldon. He's talking about Zoom and using the video camera or not. And when he didn't use the video camera, it used to show a still photograph. And suddenly that stopped working, and now it just shows his name. How do you restore the photograph?
That's you go to log in at Zoom, zoom.us, log in there, and you go to your profile there, and you can add a profile picture. And it is highly dependent on the account you are using. So if you happen to have multiple accounts that you log in as, it typically will log you into, like if you just click a link that is a Zoom link, it will log you into Zoom using whatever last login ID you used and use that profile. But it's under that profile that you actually set your profile picture.
Oddly, I'm not sure what email I used, but my non-video picture was actually taken from Google, from my picture from my Traveling Tom Google account.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think that same or similar advice, Chris, was just given by Bob Harris in the chat. He says you can change your picture. He says sometimes an update blocks access to old photos. So maybe Zoom updates are linked to Windows Patch Tuesday or something.
They're taking lessons from Microsoft, unfortunately.
Well, that reminds me of something. Have people heard of Zero Patch?
Yes.
Apparently not.
Yes, not for any OPatch or Zero Patch, depending on how you want to pronounce it, is supposedly available for when Microsoft stops supporting stuff. So if people, I understand, have been using it for keeping their Windows 7 machines alive. And I think possibly older versions of Office.
It's not just that. I believe it's zeropatch.com. I'll bring it up. It patches not only kind of Windows, but a whole variety of programs that have found security things. And there's a free version that does a lot of stuff, and then there's a paid version, mainly for companies, that does more. But basically, it does a quick little patch in memory of a security hole. But if you let's all put it in the chat. Oops. the link in the chat. But I've been using it, and every so often I get a little message saying, oh, two more patches added. So it's something that people may want to look into and perhaps install. It's been recommended. It's obviously it runs in your memory and changes it. So it is a possible vulnerability if you don't trust it.
Yeah, I would urge caution to anybody who is going to patch their operating system outside of Microsoft. I don't know. You're certainly not going to get help from Microsoft if things go badly.
Yeah, from the web page, I put the blurb in the chat. But the advantage of it is that it doesn't just happen on Patch Tuesday. It happens as soon as they figure out, as soon as they see problems, then figure out a patch for it. I presume it then checks to see if Microsoft has patched it in their own way and then deletes the patch that they had.
Okay, do we have any other questions or comments or...
One last comment, if I could bring us back to Android storage space. An app that Alan recommended some time ago was Norton Clean for cache cleaning. And I've been using it semi-religiously on one of my phones. And I'm just looking at the stats now. And for the past 179 days, I've managed to clean up 552.2 megabytes of cache and 276.6 megabytes of miscellaneous junk files, which brings me to a total of 826.9 megabytes. And that's, sometimes it's only a few kilos a day, sometimes it's a couple megabytes, but that's almost a gigabyte.
Yeah.
Mind you, it's almost 6 months too, but,
but still, yeah. If it hadn't been for that, you might have been, you know, still at this point in time using up a gigabyte of space unnecessarily, totally. Yeah. So.
Well, it's a very idiot-proof fast way of doing a light dusting, because you can still drill down and go to your each app and manually clear the cache for each app and get better results. But you'll spend a lot more time doing that. But this is kudos to Alan for recommending this app as a quick way of saving some space on the phone.
Well done, Alan. Mike V, do you want to elaborate a little bit on share remove.bg?
Yes, so this I just discovered, I just tried it once, but the BG stands for background. So you go to this site, remove.bg, and you upload an image, and then you say remove the background, and it just gives you like the figure that's in the foreground. So I just tried it once. It was pretty cool. You know, if you got a lot of noisy background or you want to do something artistic with an image, it worked well.
So yeah, I recall that. Yeah, it's for images. Yeah, that's I did use that a number of years ago, and it was interesting how good a job it did.
How does it decide which is the foreground?
Well, it decides.
It's not it's a person. If it's for it's a person, it's a foreground.
Yeah, I think that it's mainly for a person or a pet, I guess.
I seem to recall trying it on a couple of other things too, and like, I think it was like it would work when there were other prominent objects in the foreground. So if you had like a barn in a field or something, you know, it might remove all of the sky and things like that and leave just the barn there. I can't remember all of the details on it, but it was pretty impressive for a free program to be able to do that. I have photo editing software that will do a much more sophisticated job of removing backgrounds, but it's not as easy and it's not free. So kind of interesting. I know that they have a pay model there too. If you have a lot of photos that you actually want to do background removals on, there is a pay model that you can get a whole bunch done whereas the free version, there is a limit to how many you're allowed to do. But yeah, an interesting program for sure, or site. Thank you.
I got the profile thing in order to change the picture on Zoom if you are interested to show to see it. Or...
Sure.
Okay. Okay, so I think everybody she can see the screen now.
Now we can.
Okay, so it's, if you go to the website zoom.us/profile, you can click on edit. And there you can change your picture or change your name or whatever you want to change.
So, very good. Thank you, Jess.
You're welcome.
Okay, any last things before we wrap it up for the night? Okay, Alan, you want to lead us through the last slides?
Indeed, there's only two of them. The last session of Tech Cafe at the Ottawa Public Library is our good friend Bob Walker talking about autonomous vehicles. So that will be on next Monday, June the 21st at 4 in the afternoon. And if you want to hear Bob's presentation, don't forget you have to register for it with the library. They will send you the logon credentials for the Zoom session. And our next Zoom session will be next week, next Wednesday, June the 23rd. So you've all seen how to do shares. We expect everybody to do a share next week or have questions or provide answers to questions that we post ahead of time if we get questions ahead of time. And we hope you enjoyed tonight, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
And I'll throw in a reminder as well. Don't forget that September is coming up faster than we might like. And the topic at member is going to be members' favorites, which means everybody in the user group. And we have one person who has come forward so far, Stefan Richard. And he's going to be talking about databases and show us in 15 minutes how you can build a complete system. But we have lots of openings available, so if you have anything that you would like to share at members' favorite, 10 or 15-minute presentation, and you have a chance to win a 2-terabyte portable external hard drive. Okay, so with that, I will stop the recording.